Good morning, everybody. First of all, my thanks to Rabbi Lam, good friend, teacher, for introducing me, and indeed our experience together in this conference in Bimut has always been something very special and unusual. And in fact, a little later in my shiur, I will refer to something which we discussed at the time in that chavruta of ours. I also want to thank Jonathan Cohen and Rabbi Levi Mostovsky for making this possible. And I would like to thank one of our alumni students, Jonathan Udrand, for accompanying me here at this lecture tour, fundraising tour for our school in Yerushalayim. There is one figure in Tanakh, in Chumash, in Jewish tradition, which stands out by all means. Fascinating personality, disturbing personality, and even I would say an irritating personality. I'm referring to the man who started the Jewish tradition, Yahadut. Nobody less but Avraham Avinu. This person to me is the most unusual of all human beings who ever walked around, because he's the man who invented the Jewish tradition. He started it. And I've always been occupied, specifically because I do not myself come from a religious background, but from a secular background, with his personality, or what happened to the man that he was able to bring this about, to develop a tradition over the many years which ultimately captured the world, created Yahadut, and obviously had all sorts of different offsprings in the form of Lahavdil, Christianity, Islam, ethics, philosophy. And the question which obviously needs to be asked is, how did the man get to this? How do you make a choice to become a Jew? And when I say it is irritating, I mean to say by that I wonder if I can live up to this. To become somebody who has some relationship with that great moment when this man stood out and started this incredible wisdom, this unbelievable tradition. Obviously, there have been also non-Jews who walked into the Jewish tradition later. You have Yitro, you have Ruth HaMoabiah, we'll read about her very soon on Shavuot. But Avraham Avinu makes a choice for a tradition, for a lifestyle, which didn't exist. If today somebody wants to become Jewish, he at least knows what he goes in for. Avraham Avinu at the time had really no idea. He had to create it himself. And I believe it is incredibly important to try to understand what moved him, what brought this about, because we in our own lifestyle and our own ways, we also need somewhere to become an Avraham Avinu. To make that choice on our own, and not just because of an inheritance or because we are just born as Jews. If you look at the Midrashim, and there are many of them, you also get an understanding of what the man had to go through to make that decision. Not just an intellectual or religious choice, but the price which you pay for it. The Midrash speaks about Akarut, which here means that he needs to be uprooting himself from all what was there up till that moment. There's kriya, there's tearing away, there's tiltul, there's journeying around, the concept of exile. Even the Midrash happens to mention the concept of teruf, which means to say a kind of madness, to be able to do this, to pull away and move in a different direction than the whole of mankind actually moves into. The man gets exiled. The man no doubt gets condemned at the moment by the rest of the world. He becomes an outcast. He becomes an ultimate protester against so many things which he doesn't agree with. And as we know, many midrashim, no time now to discuss that, the man indeed pays an enormous price for making that to happen. But he pulls through, and ultimately he gets it on the road. One of the issues which bothers me is that if indeed Avraham Avinu started this tradition, this whole way of living, why was it that the Torah was not given to him? Why did it take hundreds of years, only in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, that he happened to receive the Torah? There's a long period from Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the 12 tribes, up till Mitzrayim, through Mitzrayim, the desert, till we get to Sinai, Shavuot, but that's a long time afterwards. And if at the same time we are being taught that to be Jewish means to live in according to the mitzvot, and for that you really require the Matan Torah, why then is that Matan Torah not taking place the moment that this man makes this choice? Hashem should have responded to him and said, okay, you're ready? Here are my mitzvot. Here are my commandments. There is a very interesting ketuf, the Kabbalah, on this matter. You have it in front of you. I shall not read it with you because there's no time. I just want to tell you, but you can read it afterwards carefully. Very worthwhile reading. Where the Ketuf HaKabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, one of the great, great commentators of the later days, he discusses one phrase in the parasha in Shemot. The Torah is often called an Eish Ochelet, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called an Eish Ochelet, a consuming fire. And the Ketuf HaKabbalah asks the question, what does this mean, an Eish Ochelet? It's an unusual word. Or it describes the Torah, or it describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it means to say that we somehow find ourselves here in some kind of a paradox, because if we only say, he says, that the Torah or HaKadosh Baruch Hu is like Eish, it is like fire, I understand fire is a concept of Ruchanit, a Ruchani concept, a spiritual concept, but Eish Ochelet, that it is a consuming fire, seems to be destructive. It seems to break something down. How can that be? Asks the Ketuf HaKabbalah. And he says something marvelous, which I believe is in many ways a key to understand this Avraham Avinu. I read to you in a translation which I made. The truth is, he writes, that the people of Israel were not equal in their spiritual level when they stood at Ma'amat Har Sinai. When they were surrounding the mountain, each one has his own madrega, his own spiritual condition. And they did not see, he writes, or perceive the same kind of revelation at Sinai. How is that? And he responds, rather, each one was only able to receive this revelational experience in accordance with the spiritual condition of his soul. Every Jew saw something at the time of the Matan Torah, but what he experienced was directly proportional to the preparation he had put into it. When a person was less prepared for the Matan Torah, he only experienced a minimal level of revelation. And if he prepared more, he got more out of it. And then the Ketuf HaKabbalah continues like this, and this is a genius insight. He says, the perception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's greatness is exactly the same as the way fire holds on to various objects. There are items which are by nature combustible. Matters like petrol, oil, they are by nature combustible. And when you touch them with a flame, they produce an enormous fire. It doesn't take much. But there are also items which, when you put a flame to them, nothing will happen. It takes a long time. A piece of metal, water, all these stand in opposition to fire. Nothing will happen. They will remain immune. Says the Kitab HaKabbalah, just like nature has made certain materials receptive to fire, so it is with the Torah. Why is it that the Torah calls itself an Esh Ochelet, a consuming fire? It means not destructive, he says. It means that somehow one has to become combustible to the fire. If I identify it, if it becomes a unity, because like oil, I'm able to relate to the very fire itself, then I get more out of it. The fire, the brand within my neshama gets much greater, and therefore I have a greater amount of revelation, an existential revelation taking place at Sinai. But if I'm less combustible, if that fire is not consuming me, then obviously I get much less out of that experience. Everything, says the Kitab HaKabbalah, depends on one question. Hachana. How much do you prepare yourself beforehand so that you will indeed be able and to be open, acceptable, conducive to that particular moment? That's a remarkable insight. One cannot somehow deal with Torah. One cannot tune into the Torah unless one is combustible to it. And then the question comes, how does one become combustible? And if you look into the Midrashim, specifically of Avraham Avinu, as the man who started all this, we see several interesting matters coming up. Each one on themselves really needs to be explained in great length, but there is no time to do this now. There is contemplation. There is something called soul searching. Meaning to say, when Avraham Avinu somewhere starts to think about the meaning and the purpose of life, of what this is all about, and obviously he's a great thinker, he starts to have what I call soul questions, neshama questions. What is this all about? Why do I find myself at this moment in this world? What does this mean that people of Bei Avodah Zarah, that they are idol worshippers? What are they looking for? What are they searching for? And you can be sure that the man, and according to different proportions, there are different interpretations, the man takes a long time to go through all these inner wars, these conflicts within himself to find out, what am I going to do with my life? They burn in him. I remember that I once heard that the famous Professor Reinhold Niebuhr here in New York, Protestant thinker, used often to open up his lectures with the following statement. There is nothing more irrelevant than an answer to a question nobody asks. There is nothing more irrelevant than an answer to a question nobody asks. One of the big problems is that if you are not a questioner, you may have all the answers and you will never understand that any of them are answers. And as Heschel, Abraham Joshua Heschel, used to say quite often, and he writes in his book, God in Search of Man, he writes over there, one should realize one thing, that indeed the Torah is a response to the ultimate questions of man. But since the Torah is only the response, it's only the answer, it is man who has to look for the questions, the ultimate existential questions, and then looking back into that Torah, you get an answer. But man lost the questions. We're now looking in the Torah the wrong way around because we believe that there is something written over there and we do not realize that it is a response to something. And it is exactly that issue which seems to be that what motivated this Avraham Avinu. What is this all about? Why do I exist? What is the existential implication of all this? And so he starts to look for it, and when he looks for it, something most interesting happens. I call that the incubation time of the Jewish tradition. It is the moment that things are being questioned, being asked, sought over, thought about, war taking place within oneself, slowly to get some answers, they break down again, I have to try them again from another perspective, till ultimately somehow I start to see some kind of image which slowly comes about and it rises, it is born within the personality of Avraham Avinu. That time is not yet a time for Avraham to receive the Torah. He's not yet ready for it. He's still working on it to be able to be open to the possibility that later somehow the Torah can be given. And in a similar way, we actually read that as we do just before Shavuot, when the days of the Hachana, the 3 days or whatever time it was, or perhaps if you want to say the 49 days of the counting of the Omer, are as a moment of incubation, trying out, fighting the things, so that when I do stand at Sinai, I ultimately indeed get the message, because I realize it is a response to my personal issues, to what I want to understand what my life is all about. This is not a matter of inheritance. This is a fight. This is a war taking place. But there's something else. The famous Holocaust philosopher who lived his last years in Yerushalayim, and I had the opportunity a few times to speak with him, was Professor Emil Fackenheim. Man who has written a lot about the Jewish tradition, and also he was not completely within the Orthodox world. He did say some very interesting things. And he spoke in one of his books, one of his most famous books, he writes about another need for Jews before they are ready to receive the Torah. He calls that root experiences. And what he means by that, long story, is that he speaks about it in ways that Jews, before they are ready to receive the Torah, they need to have, Carl Gustav Jung would call that an archetype. There has to be something happening within them which takes place and grows through all the generations, starting with Avraham Avinu up till the moment at least of Sinai, where primordial mental shapes take place which create the Jewish neshama, the Jewish neshama, through all sorts of historical experiences. So there is the experience, he says, of moments when there's a breakthrough in the historical situation of the Jews, such as the 10 plagues, such as Kriyat Yamsuf, such obviously as the Matan Torah, the 40 years walking through the desert, all the things that happen over there, they deeply root themselves within the Jewish personality, and out of that a particular kind of human being is created, comes about, which because of the fact that he went through that experience, he is now more open and more combustible to the moment when the Torah is being given at Sinai. So there is the soul searching on one side, the personal way of war to understand what my life is all about, and at the same time there's a long period, which again I call the incubation period, where slowly but surely the Jewish neshama has been created, built itself up, so that by the time the Torah is given at Sinai, there is a condition created by which it becomes possible that the Torah actually starts to make sense and can be received by those neshamot which stand at that moment at Har Sinai. But it's a time of incubation, a religious existential upheaval which needs to take place a long time before people are ready for such a moment. I believe that there are two schools within the Jewish tradition. Two schools about which one of them we are all involved in, and also one which I believe has lost a lot of its influence and we somehow have to rebuild it again. One school I call the Beit Midrash of Moshe Rabbeinu. It is the classical Beit Midrash which we all know, the yeshiva, the concept of learning, the sukyot in the Gemara, the chakirot, the lundus as we call it, all the things which we normally understand what today we discuss and study when we are busy Jewish learning. But there is also a Beit Midrash. There is an incubation Beit Midrash. There is a Beit Midrash which I call the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu. It is the Midrash which is trying to understand what happened to Avraham Avinu and all those afterwards, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the 12 tribes, when all this was just building up but had not yet accumulated in the moment of the Matan Torah. That's a different story. That's a different kind of a Beit Midrash, because it is not there where we look for halacha, but what precedes the halacha. How that halacha came about. How it slowly built up to a moment that you were saying something like, now we need the halacha to respond to what in the incubation time slowly has developed within the human being and within the Jewish people. And it's obviously for that reason that indeed the Torah cannot be given straight away to Avraham Avinu. And what needs to happen, in my humble opinion, is that somehow we have to rediscover again the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu. Trying to understand what went the man through, what happened to him. What do we know about within the Jewish tradition about it? What has the Midrash, the Gemara, what has it to say about it before it developed into the halachic system as we know? Because the halacha grew out of this and could not have been given in an earlier state when people were not yet ready to be existentially able to be combustible to what the halacha is requiring of man. A breeding period, if you want to call it by that name. Looking for the Jewish tradition and to understand it is far from easy. It's a long, difficult undertaking. It is indeed going back to the starting point, to the moment of departure where indeed Avraham Avinu starts with this, and somehow, and I'll come to that in a moment, we have to retroactively go back to these days fully to understand what this tradition is actually trying to teach us and how to live our lives. But along with that, besides the soul searching, besides the war, the inner war within man, there's obviously also something else which Avraham Avinu is looking for. It is the concept which is also developed within the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu of Midot Tovot, of highly sophisticated spiritual characteristics. The concept of Kedusha needs to get born. The concept of Tahara, of purity, needs to get born. All this takes place so that at a certain moment Avraham Avinu stands out as the first one. Yitzchak stands out, Jacob stands out. It reminds me of this beautiful story which they tell about Rav Yisrael Salanter, when they asked him, the man who started the Musar movement, somebody came up to him and says, who was your main teacher? Who was your main rebbe? So he said, my main rebbe was Rav Sundel Meister Land. So they said to him, so how long did you learn under him? And he said the following words, ich hab ihn einmal gesehen. I once saw him, that's all. But the moment I saw that man, everything changed in my life. Suddenly everything was different. Because I realized that a personality was standing here in front of me who had an encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who lived that life, who constantly understood what kind of situation he found himself in, was constantly searching, no doubt fighting with himself. And once you meet a person like that, then everything changes. My rebbe was only 1 second, but that second is exactly what it is. That, my dear friends, is Avraham Avinu. I'm sure that Avraham Avinu, the moment he walked around, and I would be able to explain loads of stories concerning him, with Sarah, with Hagar, and so on, they're all related to that issue. The man changed radically once the encounter took place, once he had these questions and tried to respond to them. In some sense of the word, it is the relationship between what we today call the world of the halacha and the world of the agadah. That is what we are learning to understand, how the halacha grew out of the experience of the agadah. What is halacha? What is agadah? There are many ways to describe them. I once wrote like this. Halacha can inform a man how to act in a given situation, but he cannot provide an insight into the quality of that what is given. A sense of spiritual change which takes place when you do something and you have an inner spiritual kind of revelation taking place. Agada is to allow the unseen to enter into the physical world, to go beyond the realms of that what is definable, perceivable, and demonstrable. It allows us to begin to comprehend the finite through the world of symbolism. It is a religious metaphor, a camera, which looks right into our souls and tries to understand that when I live my Jewish life, what happens from within. Well, the halakha is the external side of this, of that what follows from that in the way how I have to react and act on the external world. What is the akadah? What is the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu? I would say it retroactively unfreezes the halakha. The halakha had to become frozen. It had to become a system. It had to be a way by which we act things out so that ultimately we can live our Jewish life and do the right thing. But you have always to understand that in some sense of the word you need to unfreeze it. You have to understand the existential background to it, from where it all started. And that is what that Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu actually is all about. And the problem which we have today in our world is that much of that world of Avraham Avinu, the struggle, the existential experience, somehow got lost on us. In some way the halakha became self-contained. It became the thing in itself. And we have forgotten about the fact how it grew into that world. How it did become about that moment when we were ready to receive it at Sinai. But Yahadut started a long time beforehand. It did not start as an halachic system. It ultimately grew into an halachic system. Somebody once wrote the following words. A plant, may continue in apparent health for some time after it has been cut, but its days are numbered. If today we look around, I cannot speak about the experience in America, I can speak about Israel, where I already lived for many years. The opposition against halakha, which is growing in many, many Israeli circles, is because one looks to this as a finite position by which you have to act things out. You have to do things, and people do no longer relate to the unfrozen form of it, of where it all started and why it all together is there. And we pay an enormous price for this. Because people look for spirituality and they do not find it in the halakha. They look around in many different places and in other religions, and Israelis, by the way, do a lot of that, because they are looking as Jews to recover and to rediscover their neshamas. But they can't find it in the halakha because it is brought to them in a way that the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu was totally lost in that situation. A few weeks ago, as you probably know, the Dalai Lama came to Jerusalem and to Tel Aviv. And I followed this a little bit. It is an unbelievable thing to see, and extremely irritating and disturbing. The amount of nice, fine Israelis who are running to this man, who is no doubt a wise personality that cannot be denied, trying to find spirituality with him. Or they go off to the Far East and they try to speak there with the gurus and with all the people over there, while the truth about it is that everything is around the corner. And the Dalai Lama, interestingly enough, long story, on several occasions said, "What are you coming to me for as Jews? You have it all around. Everywhere you can go, you pick up all the wisdom. I have nothing new to say to you." But many Israelis don't know. Many Israelis are not aware of it. Why not? Because the way how we deliver the Jewish tradition today to them is purely pseudo-halachic system, which restricts them, and they cannot see the music behind it because nobody speaks with them about it. And it's my personal opinion, and it's, by the way, why I started what is called the David Cardoso Academy in Israel. And that is to try to re-engage again in the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu. Now let me try to explain you this a little bit on a deeper level. Avraham Avinu was a man who started it out of a free choice. Nobody told him to do this. Nobody told him, "You must live that kind of a life." He found it. He understood it, that he ultimately had to get there. And as I said, it was a choice with a fight, with a war. When a man has a fight, and when he has a war, and when he has a choice, and he ultimately makes the decision, then it is an autonomous decision. I decided on to live a Jewish life. Nobody forced me into this. Nobody told me to do this. I did it out of myself. And I dare to say that if we want to continue to live alive ourselves, and definitely we want to inspire others who are perhaps not religious, if we want to make sure that they indeed understand the beauty and the greatness of the Jewish tradition, we must give them that choice, as if we place them in the shoes of Avraham Avinu and say, you become Avraham Avinu. But now we have a problem. How do you do this? And you understand what the problem is. As long as Avraham Avinu was alive, and Yitzhak and Yaakov and everybody else, and the Torah was not yet given, as long as that is the case, indeed it is a choice. You can walk out and you can walk in. And that's possibly what happened with quite a few people at the time. We know about the fact that Avraham Avinu was Megayer, says Rashi, so many non-Jews, and we don't know really what happened to them. Probably many of them walked out again, and that's absolutely fine. But the difference obviously is that once the Torah is given at Sinai, it seems that the choice is gone. There's no longer a choice, it's an obligation. You like it or you don't like it. The truth about it is you have to live in accordance to the Torah. We said, Na'aseh v'nishma, and that's it. And we didn't say it only for that generation, we said it for all the generations. Several years ago, Rabbi Lam Shlita and me had the opportunity to learn Chavruta together in front of a large crowd in England in a university where the Limud conference was taking place. And we discussed this very famous, complicated sukya in the Gemara in Shabbat in Pechet Amud Alf, which you have in front of you, which has kept the Jewish minds busy over the many years with so many different mephoshim to understand what Chazal were trying to say over there. The Torah tells us like this. Am Yisrael stands at Sinai. Says the Torah, Vayityatzbu betachtit ha'har. And they stood at the Tachtit Ha'har, which we normally translate in English, is with, they stood, the Jewish people stood at the mountain or at the foot of the mountain. But the Gemara says the word Tachtit comes from the word Tachat. And Tachat doesn't mean to say at the foot of the mountain, it means to stand under the mountain. So the Gemara takes this symbolically, literally, and says like this, that it means to say, Omar Rabbi Afdimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa, famous Gemara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took the mountain, turned it around above them, covered them with it, and told them the following. While the mountain symbolically is hanging in the air, and the Jews are down there, Tachtit Har, right under the Har, under the mountain, he says, Amar Lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to them, Im Atem Mekabelim HaTorah, if you are prepared, if you're going along with what I ask for you to live by the mitzvot, by the Torah commandments, mutaf, everything is fine and under control. Ve'im lav, but if you do not, sham tehe kevuratchem, you will get killed. I don't allow you an option. I do not allow you a choice. This is ones, dures. I force you into it. I hold that mountain on top of you, and you will not survive unless you first of all tell me that you're going to keep these commandments. To which the Gemara, as you all know, continues and says, Omar Rabbi Acha Bar Yaakov, says Rabbi Acha Bar Yaakov, this does not make any sense at all. Moda'a Rabba Le'oraita. It is a strong objection against the whole concept of Torah. Why? Because if they were forced into it, then it means to say there was no choice, and if there was no choice, you cannot speak about something called a brit. A brit, a covenant, which the Torah has always called, means to say that both parties, out of free will, entered into this agreement. But here is no such thing. Because after all, the only one who is in forcing the other one is HaKadosh Baruch Hu forcing the Jewish people. So there is a Moda'a Rabba, there is a strong objection against the whole Jewish tradition. You want to say and claim that the Jewish tradition is a choice? It isn't. They were forced into it. It may have been true about Avraham, Yitzhak and Yaakov, but at the time of the Matan Torah it was all over. There was no way out, no escape. And all you know, and the deep Tosafot already brings this, and also commentators bring this, that indeed this is a big problem, because when the Jews said their famous words, Na'aseh v'nishma, we shall do and we shall hear, it indeed seems to imply that they personally agreed on that. And if they would not have agreed on it, then they would not have agreed on it. But here it says, Moda Araba, they were forced into it. So how can it be that something can be a breed? It can be a covenant, that is to say a free choice which the Jews had to go for it to decide, or in favor or against, and at the same time we are being told that they were absolutely forced into the point that they would die in case they would not accept it. And all the Rishonim and the Acharonim are trying to understand what this means. I suppose you all remember, I don't want to go into this now, the Gemara then says that really only later on the situation got rectified, and it is in the days of Purim. And later on in the days of Purim, they say, Kibelu Rekiyemu, we will keep it out of their own free will. But that still doesn't really respond to understand what really went on with this whole Gemara. What I think it could mean is this, that you sometimes need to be commanded and forced into something before you can make a choice. First you are forced, so that afterwards you can make a choice. Now this sounds paradoxical. Is all free or is not free? What do I mean by that? And what may quite well be is what Chazal had in mind when they made that statement. Well, one has to understand one thing. You can never make a choice about something unless you know what you are choosing. A choice cannot be made about something which is abstract or which is completely gone, which I do not know about. I need to know what the choice is, A or B. But that means to say there must be a recognition of A or B. And here comes an interesting thing. How do you recognize a mitzvah? How does the mitzvah become indeed a free choice which I will decide on in an autonomous way that this is what I'm going to keep? Only when I know the mitzvah. But more than that, a mitzvah is not just an intellectual undertaking that I know because I read about it and I will then decide in favor or against it. We all know that to somehow experience a mitzvah, the first thing what it requires is to do the mitzvah. Like in the case of music, you can't appreciate music unless or you play it or you hear it. By just looking to the notes of Mozart, nobody gets influenced by that. I have to undergo the experience itself. Tell somebody who never observed Shabbat what it means to observe Shabbat. There's no way of doing this. He will one day have to observe Shabbat, and then he gets the ta'am, he gets the taste of it. He starts to understand there is music behind that which he will not be able to pick up in a book or in any other intellectual way of learning. It is the experience itself. In the Hasidic world, many different texts for that. And later on, Franz Rosenzweig, one of the great later Jewish thinkers, used to say like this. When it says Na'aseh v'nishma, it doesn't mean to say I will do and I will hear. It means to say that the deed itself is the hearing. Because when I do it, I start to hear what it's all about. If I do not hear it, or better, when I do not do it, when I don't build it out or I don't act it out, there's no way of hearing what is taking place. So Rosenzweig used to say it is in the deed itself that I hear. But how do you do that? Only when you perform the deeds. When you keep Shabbat, then you know what Shabbat is all about. When you do also mitzvot, you can only, after you have kept them and you have already somehow the time, you have the taste of it, then you understand what it means to keep them. And only then you can make a choice. Only then you can say, now I know what it's all about, I can reject it, or I can accept it. And that is perhaps what the Gemara is trying to get to. If you want to make people to make a choice in favor of the mitzvot in an autonomous way, you will first have to say to them, you know what? If you don't keep them, sham kemuratchem. It will ultimately lead to a situation where you can't make a choice because you don't know what it is. It is a choice about something which is non-existent. But once you have gone through the experience, And somewhere you pick up a little bit of the tom, a little bit of the music, the background to it, or, to come back to what I said earlier, if you get the background of Avraham Avinu's Beit HaMidrash, of what happened before it all came to this moment, then it was somehow frozen into the halachic system. As long as you don't have that experience, there's nothing to choose for. So what happens is this. The Gemara therefore says, at the beginning, there is a need indeed to be forced. So that now I have the experience. Then once I have the experience, a man really should, as we shall see in a moment, relate to it and say, now that I know what it is, I will make a choice in favor of it in the same way as Avraham Avinu started to do so many thousands of years earlier. You may ask me the following question. Why then did that not happen with Avraham Avinu? If Avraham Avinu needed a long amount of time before he was what I call the incubation time, when the Jewish tradition was still an embryonic kind of, let's say, development before it developed into what it is today, or it is since the days of Sinai. If the only way how you can understand the Torah and to live that Torah life is by actually doing it, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu not say to Avraham Avinu, go and straight away keep Shabbat? By the way, I agree, I'm fully aware of the fact that our Midrashim would say that he kept the mitzvot. But there's a lot of discussion, if you look at the portion, what that means. That doesn't mean to say that he halachically kept them like we do today. He may have had a sense of them, but it doesn't mean to say that there was yet an halachic system. Why was it not given to him straight away? Because after all, if you don't keep them, if you don't observe them, you can neither hear them. But here I come back to what I said before. The difference is this. The root experience had not yet taken place. At the time when Avraham Avinu has to go through that, his neshama has not yet developed that he can hear the music behind the mitzvah. The mitzvah is still an external element within him. Because his neshama has not yet been developed in a way that is open, that the root experience, that the archetypal kind of situation and condition of his soul is ready to receive it. For that you need a long period of time, hundreds of years. It has to build up. Then when you come to Sinai, and then you tell the Jews, now you are forced to keep them so that a moment afterwards you can make an actual choice. And that choice you cannot really get away with, because once you have the palm, you have the music, you hear the Avraham Avinu behind it, the Beit HaMidrash of Avraham Avinu behind it, then you know what? Then you will see that there's only one choice to make, and that's a choice in favor of all this. That may quite well be the reason why the Torah was given in a much later stage. It needs a catharsis, as we say. It needs a moment when indeed we have to go ourselves through that kind of an experience. I would suggest like that. And I agree and I admit that it's not without its problems. And one has to think more about it. And one has to discuss this. If we want to bring the Jewish tradition back today to the Jewish people, we have to understand one thing. We are living in days where human autonomy is the key word to education. There's no such thing anymore as forcing somebody into anything. The whole atmosphere, the whole ruach in this world has changed drastically. But how do you hold out under those conditions when here there is a system, there's a way of living which doesn't seem to allow for that? I'm forced. I have to keep the mitzvot. I dare to say the only way, and I think it will work, is when indeed we will bring this Jewish tradition in the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu's ways. Not by Moshe Rabbeinu. Do not misunderstand me. The Beit Midrash of Moshe Rabbeinu is extremely important. But we have to realize that we can fully understand it only when we first have the experience through the agadic world of Avraham Avinu to the build-up which we have to take place, has to take place within ourselves. We need to learn so that we are able to make a choice and say, I decided, like Avraham Avinu did himself, that this is what I want all about, what I want to live by. How do I know that? Have a look in the Hasidic world. The Hasidic world has done unbelievable things sometimes by very creative souls. How often do we not learn? The Chumash does not tell us that we must keep the mitzvot as if they are given hayom, today. Rav Lemes, dit en dat is topic. Hayom, on this day. What does this mean? Does it mean to say that I should just experience and say, well, I do as if today the Torah was given to me in the 21st, in the 26th year 2006? Does it mean that, or is there more to it? So the Hasidic masters make a remarkable observation. Hayom means to say something else. It also means to say, I should keep a mitzvah, I should relate to a mitzvah as if I do it for the first time. As if I've never done it before. I'm laying tefillin already for many years. But the only approach of understanding what tefillin is all about, or any other mitzvah is all about, is that when I look to it, I say, you know what? I never did this before. This is completely novel. This is a complete chidush. This is something completely different from the day before. How do you do this? They tell the story about the Saint Franz Rosenzweig. He's a very interesting example of a Baal Teshuvah who later in his life came back to the Jewish tradition after he nearly had baptized into Christianity. That one day they went up to him and they said, well, are you laying tefillin? And he answered with this very beautiful way. He used to say, not yet. Not yet. The not yet, I'm not sure what he means. Was he already laying tefillin? Or was he saying, well, I'm trying already for weeks and months and years to put on tefillin. Yes, I have them on my hands and on my forehead, but I haven't laid them yet. Because the question is of hayom. Have I understood it? Have I understood what it means? Have I read the Beit Midrash of Avraham Avinu into this, the whole agadic world behind it, so that now I can actually claim hayom. This is the first time that I did so. In the same way, I once spoke to one of the greatest musicians of our days, who told me, when I asked him, tell me something, don't you get bored when every time you play the same symphony and the same concerto all over again? And this remarkable man said to me, I've never played it before. What do you mean you've never played it before? I know you played it since you're 5, 6 years old. He says, you don't understand. Every time when I play it, it is completely new. That's hayom. That's the issue of where a man should get to, where we have to try to train our young people to, so that they realize that there is, I call that, a ladder of observance. You have to rediscover the mitzvot once more, so that when you do encounter them, it is something which you have never had before, at any time. That's the condition of Avraham Avinu. That's exactly what happened to him, and why it stayed novel with him, and why it never got boring, which is one of the most dangerous things within religious education. So my friends, my humble opinion is that if we want to rebuild Jewish education, and Baruch Hashem today Jewish education is many times better than it used to be in the past, Yeshiva University is a tremendous example of that, I would suggest we must give much more time to this concept of Avraham Avinu. We must rebuild, we have to say to ourselves, let's try to follow the man through his struggles. How did he get to that? What happened at the incubation time? How did it grow into the experience? How did it ultimately lead to the absolute need of the halakha? Then we can appreciate the halakha for what it really is. But if we jump into the halakha from the other way, we start on the end instead of the beginning, then we often lose out on what it is all about, because then it becomes purely a frozen system. And we do not understand that you have sometimes to unfreeze it and to make it open again to the debate and to the discussions, not just halachically, but also existentially, to understand what the man went through. And if we bring the Jewish tradition that way to our younger people, and I'm first of all speaking obviously about the Israeli experience, where so many people are looking around and say, give us spirituality, and they cannot find that this is the halakhic system. It is because we have not been bringing the halakhic system in the way that indeed it is a tremendous experience, and indeed it is a choice which we need to make, which we cannot escape. Ultimately, let's come down to one thing. If I can make the choice, since it is so incredibly beautiful, there is no other choice to make but in favor of it. That's the concept of Naaseh v'Nishma. We need to go back to that moment. We have to rebuild that. We have to think by way of a think tank Rabbis, professors, psychologists will have to think about it to see if there's an opportunity of doing this once more so that we are able to bring this Jewish tradition Hayom in a new way, as if I said, I've never had the experience before. Nothing is more important, I dare to say, at this hour than exactly that. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us the opportunity to do so, and that we indeed, each one of us, will find and rediscover Yahadut in a way that I can say, I made the choice myself to be Jewish, like Avraham Avinu did many years ago. Thank you very much. I just want to mention over here that there are, for those...
3 minutes, so if anybody wants to get a drink or anything, we'll begin shortly.
There are here email lists for anybody who wants to receive our emails, weekly emails in Divrei Torah. Just write down your name and your email address and you'll get it. Yep.